Lecture 2, Whig Meteor.
The Honorable Abraham Lincoln, all of 25 years old, former captain of the Illinois militia and store clerk in New Salem, Illinois, was now a member in good standing of the Illinois State Legislature. The legislature of a state that he had not quite lived in for 5 years yet at that point. Nevertheless, on November 28, 1834, Lincoln joined the other representatives from Sangamon County on a stagecoach that would bear them as a group to the state capital, downstate at Vandalia. This was unusual because normally the legislature would not have met until after the first of the year, 1835. But 1834 was turning out to be a violent and tumultuous year in American politics, and Governor Joseph Duncan had called the Illinois legislature into special session. A lot of the tumult had to do with the appearance of a new political power on the American horizon, a new political party, in fact. No one who had participated in the original convention that wrote the American Constitution in 1787 had thought to include anything in it about political parties, simply because none at that point in time even existed. But also because many of the founding fathers hoped that the American nation would prove to be so single-minded in its devotion to Republican principles, so knit together as a republic, that there would be no need for political parties to represent differing interpretations of what the principles of republicanism were supposed to be. Republicanism was supposed to be something everybody understood, everybody subscribed to, and everybody supported and participated in equally. The idea that there might, in fact, be radically differing notions of what a republic was supposed to be was unanticipated. The expectation of unanimous, united thinking on political subjects perished within a decade of the Constitution's ratification. And American politics became polarized into, on the one hand, the Federalists, with George Washington and John Adams and Alexander Hamilton as their leaders, and the Democratic Republicans, or more simply, the Democrats, headed by Thomas Jefferson. The Federalists built their policies around Alexander Hamilton and Hamilton's three great congressional reports of the 1790s, which he wrote as Secretary of the Treasury in the Washington administration. These reports were written on the subjects of manufacturing, the national debt, and a national banking system, and were written largely as recommendations for action to be taken by Congress. Hamilton's reports were brilliant articulations of the need for the new federal government to encourage and underwrite a commercial and manufacturing sector for the new republic. And Hamilton's greatest success was in convincing President Washington to allow him to establish a Bank of the United States which could provide capital for new American businesses. To Thomas Jefferson, however, banking and commerce were evil. Banks lent money, and that created debt. Debt that entrapped naive farmers and unsuspecting citizens. Commerce involved the swapping of paper, stock, certificates of deposit, paper money. Swapping paper, not real wealth, paper, illusory wealth. As far as Jefferson was concerned, the only real wealth was in land, something you could feel, something you could touch, something you could work. And men of commerce, the men whom Hamilton's reports were recommending should have the economic power of the republic put in their hands, men of commerce were, for Thomas Jefferson and his followers, unsavory, suspicious characters, who used money to concentrate influence and power in their hands and to destroy liberty. To the Jeffersonians, the only genuinely virtuous means of making a living was by agriculture, and the only real wealth was land. Let the decadent monarchies of Europe build empires on trade and exploitation the way the British had tried to do when America was a British colonial domain. Jefferson believed that the American Republic should remain a nation of independent farmers, independent because they owned their own land, they raised what they needed for all of their needs at home, and did not have any need whatsoever to have anything to do with European commercial entanglements. Now, this made for great rhetoric, but not very much economic sense. Thomas Jefferson, after all, was anything but a virtuous farmer himself, since he relied on the coerced labor of black slaves to support his own lavish agricultural experiments at Monticello. But it was the kind of rhetoric that played well to the fears and anxieties of American farmers, and farmers were by far the dominant sector of the American economy. So in 1800, Jefferson sweeps to the presidency in a landslide that makes the Federalist Party a dead letter, and installs Jefferson's Democratic Party as the dominant party in American politics pretty much for the next 60 years. And in 1808, by the way, Jefferson let the charter of Hamilton's pet scheme, the Bank of the United States, he let the charter for it lapse. Well, if this was a signal for rejoicing among Jeffersonians and among virtuous American farmers, it was rejoicing that was premature. In 1812, Jefferson's hand-picked successor as president, James Madison, overconfidently allowed the United States to be sucked into war with the greatest of all the great commercial and economic satans, Great Britain, in what became known as the War of 1812. And the result? The result was not happy for virtuous farmers. In fact, the result was a near catastrophe for the United States. The underfunded, under-equipped, and poorly clothed armies of virtuous Jeffersonian farmers were repeatedly routed by British troops equipped with the latest material supplied by the resoundingly commercial British economy. And in 1814, those same resoundingly commercial British actually chased President Madison out of Washington entirely and burned the White House. The disgrace of the War of 1812 produced some severe second thoughts among many Democrats, and in no one of them more than the talented Kentucky Congressman Henry Clay. Although Clay had howled before the war for an end to Hamilton's bank, for war with Britain, he changed his tune drastically after he watched President Madison forced to borrow money, cap in hand, from private financiers during the war just to keep the federal government going. So in 1816, Clay, swallowing his earlier words, and quite a feast of crow it was, Clay called for the refounding of a second Bank of the United States, and he followed that with proposals for legislation in Congress that would offer federal government backing for national transportation projects, because transportation projects would cut the costs of manufacturing and marketing. It would allow people to move goods from where the goods were produced to markets more swiftly, more efficiently, more cheaply. And Clay also began advocating for a national tariff, a tariff that would protect American manufacturing from competition with foreign goods and thereby encourage the development of an American manufacturing sector. Well, many Democrats were chastened enough by the dismal outcome of the War of 1812 to rally around Henry Clay. But the emerging chief of the Democratic Party, the war hero Andrew Jackson, would tolerate no deviations from Jeffersonian orthodoxy. Clay frustrated Jackson's attempt to win the presidency in 1824, But when Jackson finally won the election as president in 1828, it was clear that the knives were being sharpened for a political civil war within the Democratic Party. In 1833, Jackson vetoed congressional legislation extending the charter of the Second Bank of the United States. And the next year, Clay responded by declaring the formation of a new political party to oppose Andrew Jackson. And he gave it the name of that old English political faction who had opposed monarchy and tyranny back in the 18th century. He called his party the Whigs. The Whigs started life as a party simply and purely opposed to Andrew Jackson's policies about the bank and about tariffs. They accused Jackson of being a dictator, a military chieftain, and they did not mean that as a compliment, who yearned to become King Andrew I. But as the Whigs rallied the support of American business and American religion, the Whigs soon became distinguished for their stands on three basic issues beyond just the issue of Andrew Jackson. The first of these basic issues was the matter of economic opportunity. The Whigs became the party of small-scale urban business and finance, and usually urban businesses and urban financiers who were parts of international networks of investment and trade, or of trade which crossed state and regional boundaries. Now, this opened the Whigs to the same accusation that had been hurled at Hamilton and the Federalists, that they were simply a party for the rich. And the Whigs replied that what it really meant was that they were the party of economic opportunity. "Who are the rich men of our country?" asked a Whig newspaper. "They are the enterprising mechanic, who raises himself by his ingenious labors from the dust and turmoil of his workshop to an abode of ease and elegance. The industrious tradesman, whose patient frugality enables him at last to accumulate enough to forego the duties of the counter and indulge a well-earned leisure. If that is the rich, then the Whigs, yes, would certainly be a party for them." What that really meant, however, was that the Whigs would be the party of, overwhelmingly, the American commercial middle class. The Whigs also took, as a second basic issue, questions of social morality. After all, a successful business depends upon economic regularity and dependability and self-discipline. But self-discipline and regularity are not just matters of bottom lines. We're also touching on things which are moral issues. And the Whig pursuit of both led the Whigs into a close alliance with American religion. Now, when we speak of American religion in the 1830s, what we mean, overwhelmingly, are Protestant Christian religious denominations. Whig economics, in other words, would supply the opportunity, but Protestant Christianity would supply the morality that would keep the opportunity within the appropriate boundaries. And presumably, with a combination of both, the nation would prosper economically and morally. It would be transformed not only on the exterior material sense, but in the inward spiritual sense as well, and both would work together. Which brought the Whigs to the importance of a third basic issue, and that was national union. One way to ensure that American commerce would never prosper was to allow individual states to write their own separate rules for economic activity. I mean, if each individual state made up its own rules for economic activity as it went, then the chaos of separate state regulations would make large-scale business operation across the country an impossibility. For the Whigs, then, suppressing local, regional, and state diversity was a virtue. And nothing came to matter more to the Whigs than affirming the sovereignty of the federal government presiding over a single, unified American people. Now that meant, in practical terms, that when South Carolina tried to unilaterally nullify federal tariffs because those tariffs, as they thought, favored northern business interests and penalized southern plantation owners, then Whigs, like Massachusetts Senator Daniel Webster, would rise to denounce nullification as an attack on the Union. Alternately, when northern opponents of slavery demanded a confrontation with the southern states over slavery, Whigs like Henry Clay would rise to propose one national compromise after another to hold the southern states in the Union. And this despite Clay's personal belief that slavery was a moral wrong. Even on a question like slavery, to Henry Clay and to the Whigs, holding the unity of the nation intact was the most important principle. Now, it was to the Whigs that Lincoln attached himself from his first day as a state legislator. When he left his father's farm to work in Offutt's store, he was, just by that very action, casting a kind of silent vote in favor of the kind of commercial system that Henry Clay was proposing in Congress. And when Lincoln announced his first candidacy for the legislature in 1832, it was on a platform of government-sponsored transportation projects in Illinois, similar to Clay's. By the time he was elected in 1834, Henry Clay had become what Lincoln called his beau ideal of a statesman, an opinion he would, in fact, maintain for the rest of his life. And contemporaries would find Abraham Lincoln to be as stiff as a man can be in his Whig doctrines. So the boy on the stump, who loved to talk, became the Whig legislator speaking for Whig principles. In fact, Lincoln became very quickly one of the two principal men we relied on, said one Whig legislator, in the legislature to make speeches for us. Well, there was a great deal for a Whig to talk about in Illinois in 1834, and that was why the governor had called the legislature into special session. In Illinois, Whigs were impatiently demanding that Illinois not be left out of the overall economic development of the United States. And with that in view, the Illinois Whigs demanded support for state-level versions of the same agenda that Henry Clay was agitating for in Washington. They wanted, first of all, an Illinois state bank which could issue paper money. Now, in 1834, the federal government issued as money from its mints only hard coin, which was known as specie. Now, there was paper money in circulation, but this paper money was issued as banknotes by banks, not by the federal government. People who accepted this paper money in payment for goods and services did so at the risk of discovering that the bank which had originally issued it might be out of business or in deep financial trouble. Banks were supposed to issue no more banknotes than their own reserves of hard coin, of specie, could back up, but there were precious few regulations to prevent them from doing otherwise, especially if times were good and the demand for borrowing money high. Perhaps this should have scared more people away from using bank money. But the truth was that it was hard to transact any forms of large-scale business in hard coin. After all, $1,000 in banknotes was a whole lot more portable than $1,000 in gold coins. Imagine what that would have weighed. And it was significantly safer to store. A pile of 1,000 gold coins can be very difficult to disguise. But 1,000 banknotes, well, that's a different story. That difficulty, of course, suited the Jacksonian Democrats just fine. They were not interested in encouraging large-scale commercial transactions anyway. But to the Whigs, an unreliable paper currency meant that entrepreneurs would be unable or unwilling to embark on the kinds of major economic ventures that Whigs believed were the only way to make the United States competitive against global economic bullies like the British. The only solution, then, was for the state and federal governments to step in and guarantee the value of somebody's paper money And the best way to do that was to establish federal and state banks, which would regulate and back up the value of the paper money they issued with the full faith and credit of the state. Illinois had established such a state bank in its territorial days, and Lincoln emerged as one of the Illinois State Bank's most vigorous defenders against its Democratic critics. A second set of policies that Lincoln becomes involved with, along with the other Whigs in the legislature, concerned transportation projects, or as they were known, internal improvements. There was no sense in providing the capital for business investment if it turned out afterwards that those businesses had no way to get their goods to markets. So, as that seemed to be the principal problem that Illinois presented, Illinois, in 1834, decided to take steps. Illinois, as a state, was virtually landlocked. Chicago, and Lake Michigan, was little more than a military village. And the rest of the state had only rivers, like the Sangamon, as highways for getting goods in and out. Now again, this suited Democrats just fine, because that ensured that virtuous Illinois farmers would produce only for themselves and their own neighborhood needs, and would have no reason to connect with the corrupting networks of commerce and competition in the world around them. But the Whigs had few illusions about the virtues of farmers, something that Lincoln could agree with quite strenuously. And so Abraham Lincoln became a prime advocate in the legislature for the state funding of canals, roads, river and harbor dredging, and the new railroads, which would bring Illinois farmers into easy connection with distant markets and bring those markets, with all the allure of new goods, into the heart of the Illinois prairie. A third issue that Whigs like Lincoln become involved in is the sale of public lands. Like the house that Jack built, internal improvements projects depended on the capital made available through the state bank. And the state bank depended on revenues sent its way by the legislature. Well, where was the legislature to get such money? One obvious place was taxation. But projects of the kinds that the Whigs had in view would require ruinous taxation to support. Delighted Democrats would seize on that at once as proof of an evil commercial conspiracy to enslave independent Illinois farmers and reduce them to tax slavery. But there was one other source of revenue. Illinois had originally been organized as a federal territory by Congress out of the old Northwest Territory. Even after Illinois achieved statehood in 1818, the federal government retained title to hundreds of thousands of acres of prime Illinois farmland. Some of this land had already been sold to farmers like Thomas Lincoln. Other parts had simply been occupied by squatters who hoped to buy the land that they were squatting on at a later time when the price might be much more appetizing. And still more lay open and undeveloped all across Illinois. Democrats favored keeping things that way, so that the sale of public lands could provide a modest stream of revenue for the federal government, and, incidentally, eliminate an excuse for establishing a Bank of the United States. But the Whigs saw no purpose tying up all of that land in federal hands while the nation's economic development went a-begging. And Lincoln became a prominent voice in calling for the federal government to yield title to the public lands, in Illinois especially, so that the lands could be sold to fund the state bank and the state's internal improvements projects. All of this made Abraham Lincoln into one of the chief promoters of a business-friendly and entrepreneur-friendly economic environment in Illinois. And he was remarkably successful in managing the adoption by the legislature of an Illinois and Michigan canal, which would link Lake Michigan with the Mississippi River, a bill to fund an Illinois Central Railroad, and a variety of bridge and road projects. Re-elected in 1836 and again in 1838, Lincoln became conspicuous in bringing forward and sustaining the economic development of Illinois. In the process, he also learned the basic nuts and bolts of politics, how to speak persuasively, how to size up the progress of a legislative debate and know when the best moment was to call for a vote, how to navigate measures through committees, how to recruit allies and buck up waverers, how to bring home the pork barrel of appropriations for his constituents. By the end of his third term in the state legislature, Abraham Lincoln had become the acknowledged leader of the Whigs, as one observer put it, in the Illinois State House. And he was even put forward in 1838 and 1840 as a candidate for Speaker of the Illinois House. Now, oddly, Lincoln's own personal business ventures routinely flopped. When he returned from his service in the militia in 1832, he found Denton Offutt's store in New Salem closed, and himself, therefore, without means and out of business. He invested the bounty money that he received for his militia service in a new store, along with a partner, William Berry. But that store failed, too, leaving Lincoln owing almost $1,000. Sitting in the legislature paid Lincoln pretty handsomely by those standards, $258 for what amounted to less than 3 months' work in Vandalia. But that was quickly swallowed up in the sinkhole of his debts, and he was forced to find odd jobs to make ends meet. He won the minor job of postmaster of New Salem, largely because, as the village physician, Dr. John Allen, put it, Lincoln was almost the only man then there who could make out the returns. His friends in New Salem also wangled for him an appointment as deputy surveyor for Sangamon County. Never mind that Lincoln knew less than nothing about surveying. He procured a compass and chain, as he wrote years later, studied the basic textbooks in surveying, and as he put it in an autobiographical sketch he wrote many years later, he went at it. As Lincoln remembered, this procured bread and kept soul and body together. But it did not do much beyond that. At one point, when a creditor would wait no longer for Lincoln to pay on his debts, Lincoln had to allow his surveyor's compass and chain to be seized and sold at auction. There were, however, two things that Lincoln had in abundance. The first was self-confidence. He told a lawyer from the neighboring town of Petersburg that all his folks seemed to have good sense, but none of them had become distinguished, and he believed it was for him to become so. After all, Lincoln explained without a twinge of embarrassment, he had talked with men who had the reputation of being great men and could not see that they differed from other men. The other resource that Lincoln had was his extraordinary capacity for winning friends, and especially during his militia service in the Black Hawk War. Lincoln, said George Close, who split fence rails alongside Lincoln as a farm worker, Lincoln need not be with a man more than an hour to gain his goodwill. And short though the Black Hawk War was, it was more than long enough for Lincoln to win friends and admirers he would rely on for the rest of his life. I fell in with Lincoln first when he was captain, recalled the prominent Illinois lawyer and politician John Todd Stewart, who also served in the Black Hawk War. He was then noted mainly for his great strength and skill in wrestling and athletic sports. He was a kind and genial and companionable man, said Stewart, a great lover of jokes and teller of stories. Everybody liked him. He became very popular in the Army. In addition to Stewart, Lincoln came into contact for the first time with the future movers and shakers of Illinois politics. Orville Hickman Browning, 3 years older than Lincoln, but born, like him, in Kentucky, who had now set up shop in the western Illinois town of Quincy as an up-and-coming lawyer. The New Yorkers, Asahel Gridley, who would join Lincoln as a Whig representative in the legislature and become a wealthy merchant in Bloomington. and Sidney Breese, who would become Chief Justice of the Illinois Supreme Court. These were the people Lincoln was thrown together in the Black Hawk War with. But the most important of all was John Todd Stewart. Stewart was, like Lincoln, a Kentucky immigrant to Illinois. He sat with Lincoln in the legislature as a Whig, and in fact had started a thriving law practice in Springfield, Illinois. It was Stewart who proposed to Lincoln, in a private conversation, that Lincoln study law from books that Stewart loaned him. As Lincoln wrote years later, he borrowed books of Stewart, took them home with him to New Salem, and went at it. The same phrase he used to describe his study of surveying textbooks. Went at it with good earnest. One New Salemite remembered that when Lincoln began to study law, he would go day after day for weeks and sit under an oak tree on a hill near Salem and read, moving around the tree to keep in the shade. In the fall of 1836, Lincoln received a law license in Sangamon County, and the following year he was licensed to practice at the state level as well. And in April of 1837, Stewart formally invited him to join him as a junior partner in Stewart's office in Springfield. Lincoln, who had once had such high hopes of commercial success in New Salem, now became a lawyer, and he left New Salem, and he never looked back.